Hello and welcome to Literary Loitering. Once again, we're back to do some more of our vaguely book-related ramblings. I'm Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by Rob and Graham.
Hello. Hello. We did that together.
Yeah, that was a surprising show of unity in these divided times.
Yes, we should form a union.
Well, yes, that's why I said Rob and Graham. They're actually a single hive mind.
Yes, the gestalt Rob Graham.
Well, that was a good joke, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what our mashup name could be.
Robham.
The Grobham.
Grobham, that's good. That sounds like a footballer from the 70s.
Well, no, because we sound like some alien entity that rules over a billion planets, you know, the Grobham. The yes. Mighty Grobham.
See, which... I was thinking maybe like the mighty Ray-Am.
Ray-Am, yes. Yeah, true. It sounds a bit like an X-Man.
Yeah. Or we could be a space pirate, Robham.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's a pretty fruitful conversation there. Good work, everyone. See you next week.
Yes.
Oh, I think this is probably the best show we've done.
Yeah.
Yes. Certainly has the most book content.
No, we actually have a book today.
Oh, wow.
I know. That certainly is a novel idea.
Oh.
He's having to pinch it for me because I'm kind of ill. I think I've got a chest infection, so... Andrew's having to take over the bad puns as well for me today.
Yes, that's the first sign of a chest infection. The punning capacity goes first.
Oh, God, yeah. I can't laugh as much because I suddenly start coughing and then I feel like I'm dying.
I am the backup pun generator.
Yes.
We'll try to be unfunny for your benefit.
Sorry, backup pun generator is something that I really want to see on a T-shirt. Do we have blurb? Is there blurb? Did we do blurb?
Of course there's blurb, Rob. The blurb is just exactly what I was getting to because I'm a consummate professional and definitely didn't forget. So, if you like the show, you can find more of us online at thegeekshow.co.uk, where we have all past episodes of this, as well as a bunch of other shows you can listen to. And we also have a donate link on the right-hand side of the website if you want to help us keep doing what we love doing. Or if you want to do that thing, what I just said, but also get some cool stuff in return, we have the Geek Shop, where we've got lots of lovely items that you can buy.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, should we head into the news?
No, I refuse. You can't make me.
Excellent. Let's go. Now, Rob, we're usurping your authority.
What do you mean? I have no authority.
He's grown too powerful, Rob. Yes.
Man, that was our gestalt mind did not last long, did it?
No, part of me rebelled. It's my brain, I tell you, it hates me.
Should we start with a bit of art news?
Yes.
Yes, art news is always fun. The new occupants of the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square have been announced. This has been the site of some right old tat. In the past, the current commission is Giant Black Thumbs Up, created by David Shrigley.
Oh, is that empty plinth that they kept putting, like, stupid things on?
Yes, that's the one.
Oh, God.
The next two items revealed, and I'm going to read out the first two paragraphs of the Guardian story, because I think they've worded this in a slightly confusing manner.
Okay.
First paragraph. A dollop of glistening cream, complete with a cherry and a functioning drone, and a recreation of an ancient sculpture destroyed by ISIS, will be the next artworks to sit on the fourth plinth in London's Trafalgar Square. Michael Rakowitz's piece, The Invisible Enemy Should Not Exist, will occupy the plinth from 2018. The work is a response to what Rakowitz called the cultural genocide and the accompanying human tragedy happening in places such as Iraq and Syria. Right, just to make it clear, the response to the cultural genocide and human tragedy happening in Iraq and Syria is not the dollop of cream.
Yeah, because I was confused. I was thinking, is it the dollop of cream that he's talking about, or is it the other one?
I mean, the other one is a very worthwhile piece. There's a picture of it here. It looks beautiful.
Is it a completely original piece? Is it not neither of those two? And it's basically just an empty plinth.
It is actually a reconstruction of an ancient Babylonian sculpture of a winged lion with a human head. Because
I thought that before in Castlevania, I think.
The problem is with the wording of this article is that as soon as you start reading it, you're just thinking, what's this with the cream and the cherry? And it doesn't matter how much it talks about Rakowitz's piece, a lot, as it turns out. You are just thinking, what about the cream and the cherry?
Actually, I'm thinking, I'm hungry.
Yes.
Can I ask the cream and the cherry and the functioning drone?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm glad you picked up on that, because I'm thinking, hang on, is the drone, is the cream and the cherry, like, is it massive and going to sit on the plinth, or is it quite small and it's got a drone underneath so that every so often the artist can come along and then you've just got this flying cream with a cherry on top flying around Trafalgar Square just taking secret photos of people because the artist is a bit of a voyeur.
Should we have some words from the artist?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I'm excited.
Yeah, this is almost on a naked boys reading level of pretentiousness. Philipson said, this is Heather Philipson, who has made the cream, cherry and drone construction. She was overwhelmed to be able to display work in such a social and politicised context and said that her sculpture reflected the congregational and celebratory aspect of Trafalgar Square as well as its political importance as a gathering spot for protest. I think my work exists somewhere in the realm of exuberant unease, so this is apparently very celebratory at first glance, but the more you spend time with it, other elements will start to creep in, she said. The plinth becomes a monument to hubris and impending collapse.
That's just pretentious as hell.
To be fair, I kind of get what she's saying. I think once I've spent about like 10, 20 minutes staring at just a giant pile of cream, I'm going to start hating the hubris of mankind as well.
Yes. It just gives me an impression of, you know, Charlton Heston at the end of Planet of the Apes screaming, why, on his knees in front of a giant dollop of cream.
See, it just makes me think of Charlton Heston at any National Rifle Association rally. From my cold, dead hands.
But that's, I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm in more of a politicised space already.
Yeah, but my politicised space that when I think about this has a lot more, it's a lot more disturbing because all the politicians are covered in white stuff and some of them are conveniently placing cherries in certain places. And I'm just thinking, no, that's just wrong.
How did you find out about my big boys of Brexit calendar? Yeah.
Please don't make me laugh.
You've finally done it, Graham. Now we move in. Now we take the things.
We were discussing before we went to record the possibility of Rob actually dying on this show, and Andrew's ever compassionate immediate response was, I'm taking the comic books.
I like to think of myself as a practical man.
I'm still here, you know.
Oh, okay.
Calm, Blue Ocean. Sorry, the big boys of Brexit. This joke.
I mean, that puts that statement that Donald Tusk made about missing you already in a whole new context.
Also, every time I hear Donald Tusk's name, I just think, this is the villain in an extremely unsubtle Disney cartoon about diversity. He's like a racist elephant with a bad wig.
Actually, I can see that. Know. In like Zootopia 2.
You just know this is what Zootopia 2 is going to be about.
Yeah, you've got Donald Tusk as an albino elephant with one tusk.
Yes.
Because the other one was cut off in the war. God, I'm making him sound like an awesome character.
Yeah, we should write this.
Anyway, shall we move on?
Can they defeat him by all chanting that Donald There's only got one tusk.
Oh, God. shall we move on?
Yes.
Right.
Urgently.
Now, I'm not sure how to explain this, but over in Florida, right? If you're...
I thought it was a good way to start a story.
Oh, yeah.
If you're looking to get rid of old books, there are certain ways to get rid of them, right?
Mm.
You can take them to a charity shop or a second-hand store. You can give them away or take them to a library and donate them. You can donate them to a school or something like that. There are lots of ways to get rid of them, yeah?
Yeah.
And I, for one, will never, ever condone the burning of books.
Hmm.
Even more so when you have a particular Florida man who decided to burn some old books. Not out of maliciousness or anything like that, just because they were old books and he just wanted to get shot of them.
Hmm.
The guy hasn't been identified, but his book burning caused a little accident.
Oh.
Yeah. He basically caused a forest fire 20 miles wide. That destroyed at least 10 homes.
Oh, God.
That's fine. He's thinking ahead. It's like, I already don't have space for all the books I've got. So why don't I just burn down all the trees so there won't be any new books?
Yes. Imagine using that as your excuse, though. I mean, I imagine you'd feel stressed enough being hauled in front of the police, having destroyed 10 homes and caused an enormous forest fire. But to have to go, yes, officer, it started innocently enough when I was holding a book burning.
Yes.
I think we have to look at the possibility that he was just burning down all that forest to create Lebensraum for his bookshelf.
I'm not sure why he was burning books in the forest in the first place.
No.
Or anywhere near the forest.
Yes.
As a pro tip for all our listeners, when you're looking to burn something, maybe don't choose a place surrounded by flammable materials.
Yes.
Yeah, this is what got me into trouble when I went out to burn just burning autumn leaves, really, something everyone does, but no one told me not to do it in the oil refinery.
Yeah. The guy was understandably devastated because he didn't intend to do anything like this. He just didn't think. And that kind of sums up a lot of what's happening right now in America.
Yes. That, in fact, when some future David Kynaston or Dominic Sandhall or whoever writes the history of this decade, that's the title, isn't it? I didn't mean to do anything wrong. I just didn't think. Britain from 2010 to 2020.
Well, when you think about it, this entire article is kind of representative of the state of America right now, getting rid of old books and accidentally burning everything down.
Yes. Yes, that's some draining the swamp right there.
Yes.
I had a friend who once drunkenly burned a book. I will not name this friend because they shared the incident back on their live journal because this happened in the year 1876 when people had live journals.
Before we all switched to that permanent bastion of social media, MySpace.
Yes! Let me just fire up my AOL account and send a message to Andrew thanking him for that excellent quip. There we go. Should arrive in 2 to 3 months.
Yes.
Don't be ridiculous, Graham. You have to wait for the hour for the dial-up first.
No, no, no. You've got to wait for your Netscape browser to load first.
Yes.
And then go to your Alta Vista search engine.
Ask Jeeves.
No, no. Lycos. Lycos was the other alternative, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. God, no wonder Google cleaned up, isn't it?
Like us in Alta Vista that were covered in all sorts. And then Google appeared and Google was just like clean and simple.
Yeah.
You know, no adverts or anything like that. You just go, I prefer this.
We've basically let them get away with murder because all search engines were so terrible.
Oh my god. Google is the Donald Trump of search engines.
Dun, dun, duh. Except I'm not sure you could say Donald Trump is very clean. I mean, even if the allegations from that MI6 man's dossier are inaccurate, he still looks like he probably skimps on a wash every now and then.
Yes. Also, did you see the picture I chose for the last episode of Literary Writery?
Oh, I haven't yet, no. Let me have a look at this. Yes. Yes, fantastic. I'm down with that.
I thought it fits the title. So anyway.
Yes.
Anyway. Where were we?
Yeah. We were. I don't know where we were, actually. It's quite strange and confusing.
Indexes. I think you were going to talk about indexes.
To Google to Donald Trump. So.
Yeah. I think you were going to talk about indexes, Graham. Let's stay on topic.
Let's stay on topic. Just before I do, I want to justify my anonymous friend who only burned a book because he was the bookseller in 2005 and the book was The Da Vinci Code.
Oh,
that... And it just reached a point where he had to express his frustrations any way he knew how.
See, I expressed my frustration with that, not by burning it, but by growing plants out of it.
Oh.
Yep.
That's very cool.
That is a nifty idea.
Well, yeah. It's basically, I thought, fundamentally, it's fertilizer. It's basically, it's basically shit. And I can basically mix it with soil and grow stuff.
That's brilliant.
I think either way, making there be one less copy of the Da Vinci Code in the world is not a crime.
No. I felt forgiving towards my friends. But, you know, here on Literary Loitering, we do value books as physical objects. We have never burned them. Even when sent something really dreadful to review. And one of the pleasures of a physical book for me is the index. And there was an article in The Guardian this week by Sam Leith about the Society of Indexers on... Do you ever think there's slightly too many official days, that this is National Index Day on Thursday?
Really?
Yep. This Thursday just gone, 30th of March, National Index Day.
Oh, damn. We missed it.
So, hang on. Can you just arbitrarily declare a national day like that? Because if that's the case, I want a national Rob Day. I want everyone to take the day off and celebrate me.
This is National Rob Day. Spread the word. Say it now.
If you're a Rob, celebrate, because today is your day.
Yes.
Wait. Does that mean that today is Rob Day, or it's Rob Day on the day that this episode goes out?
It's Rob Day on the day this episode goes out.
Okay, right good. Now. So we can pre-plan our Rob Day party.
Yes.
Yes.
And when I say Rob Day, I don't mean go out and rob people. I mean if your name is Rob.
Nope, sir. You should have specified that to begin with. You just said Rob.
I said if your
any
name is
kind
Rob.
Of Rob is now valid.
Yes.
Oh, God, what have I done? Did I just accidentally create the purge?
Yes, I think yes, you did, yeah. But in terms of indexes, Leith makes several very fine defences and also quotes Harold Macmillan saying an index can often give a far clearer glimpse of a book's spirit than the blurb writers or critics are able to do. But Leith says one of the things that's commonly imagined is that indexing is something that can be outsourced to a computer algorithm. Dead wrong. A concordance, essentially an alphabetical list of all the words in the book with page references, can be done by a computer. But an index, to be useful, needs to be done by a human. In a book about the Middle East, say, an entry that said Syria, page 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 10, 23, 25, 26, 27, would be absolutely no use at all. But he also notes that some indexes, and this may be something people are unaware of, can be hugely entertaining on their own.
Okay.
They mention the index to iPartridge, We Need to Talk About Alan, which it describes as at least as funny as the body text. And there are indeed some absolute gems in it. Pear Tree Productions, Partridge's production company, is listed under Genesis of As Joke Not Lie, As Sleeping Volcano, As Well-Oiled Machine, and Employment Tribunal.
Sorry, that's great.
The many, many entries, sub-entries under Alan Partridge himself include Booker Prize, comma, deserved, dance, comma, as self-expression, and muscularity of physique. Fantastically, sometimes you can just get a big laugh out of two concurrent entries, like, for example, when Hitler Adolf is followed by Holmes Amen.
Oh, I found this article that you're talking about, and I found some amazing ones in there.
Yes.
The History of Sexuality, Volume 2, contains the cherishable elephants as example of conjugal virtue.
Well, that's not something Donald Tusk would be into, because that guy is just an absolute poonhound. That's our made-up Donald Tusk, obviously. The real Donald Tusk is, I'm sure, a lovely man.
Yes. It's got a good one.
And we also have no idea about his opinions on elephant sexuality.
This is true. It also refers to a 1995 book on the computer. Contains a deliberate reference, loop, endless, see endless loop, and then endless loop, see loop, endless.
That's fantastic. My all-time favourite index, which isn't mentioned here, is How Mumbo Jumbo Conquered the World, A Short History of Modern Delusions by Francis Ween, which contains some fantastic sort of, I suppose you would call them brief condemnations, really, of some of the people that he's writing about, and it really nails hypocrisies so neatly. Edward de Bono, for example, is indexed as De Bono, Edward, declares self first original thinker since Plato, page 58. Praises Robert Maxwell, page 59.
Yes.
Paul DeMann is listed as Giant of Deconstructivist Criticism, 81, Nazi Collaborator, 95-7. Hill Norton, Lord, Quest for Little Green Men of. But also, the entry for God is magnificent. It includes Accepted by Newton, Angered by Feminists and Gays, Appoints American Coal Owners, Approves of Laissez-Faire Economics, Asked by Ayatollah Khomeini to Cut Off Foreigners' Hands, Could Have Made Intelligent Sponges, Helps Vacuum Cleaner Saleswoman, Praised by Enron Chairman, and Produces First Self-Help Manual. Once again, that is the entry. Oh, God.
It's a heck of a CV.
Yes!
I'm just imagining that job interview.
So what would you say are your qualifications for cutting off foreigners' hands? Well, it's funny you should say that. What are your flaws? If anything, I may have cut off too many foreigners' hands.
No. If anything, I think I should have styled my beard better.
Yes!
Which is especially impressive considering that God is a woman.
Yes, that's true. A bearded woman.
Oh, no. To many people, it's a fake beard. It's like that. It's like Monty Python, The Life of Brian.
Yes.
Are there any
God
women
is the
here?
Strangely alluring pirate from Pirates and Adventures.
I co-sign to this religion.
It's not George Galloway, this ethical pirate, then.
No.
I mean, that could be some kind of like rival deity.
Yes, with much worse facial hair.
Yes.
While we are talking about the pleasures of the marginal and often ignored, it is probably worth saying that the National Indexers Day article has a brilliant below-the-line comment.
Yes.
This is the first time this has happened in human history, I know. But someone with a username that is just a load of numbers, so I'm not going to read it out, says, shouldn't you have called it Indexers, comma, National Day of?
Yes. Oh, that's beautiful.
Shall we go on to something that isn't beautiful at all?
Yes, the alt-right. America's alt-right, who strangely, for some reason, and I'm still not sure why, are fans of Jane Austen.
I mean, I cannot stand Jane Austen, but even I think her memory deserves better than this.
Yeah, a study has observed references to Pride and Prejudice and to her in several white supremacist blogs.
I did have a read of this when The Telegraph published an article about this, perhaps as a way of telling their readers, here's some of the blogs you might like. But it did strike me that they seem to know almost nothing about Jane Austen. Their references to her seem to be on the basis of she was white and she wrote about weddings in old-timey days. Now, I'm not saying either of these things are untrue, but that is a level of Jane Austen knowledge that even I could outdo them on.
How does it work? What are these blog posts? Like, should shoot all the Mexicans. Also, that Mr. Darcy, what a hunk.
We did find out the other week that Mr. Darcy looks quite a lot like Julian Assange, so there is reason for Trump supporters to have a crush on him.
Yeah, I mean, there's, according to this article, Andrew Anglin, a white supremacist who blogs for the Daily Stormer website, used Austen when portraying pop star Taylor Swift as a Nazi idol.
Nazi idol is my least favourite Simon Cowell reality show.
True. To quote this, she, as in Swift, is the anti-Miley, as in Cyrus. This is from an interview he did. While Miley is out having gangbangs with coloured gentlemen, she is at home with her cat reading Jane Austen.
I mean, maybe I take pop music slightly too seriously, but I think there are several problems there. Firstly, he is perhaps the last person in history who hasn't suspected that Miley Cyrus might be a bit less wild than she wants us to believe.
Yes.
Secondly, I bet Taylor Swift is into something really weird. I think she probably has like a Howard Hughes sort of thing where like if she even shakes hands with someone, she has to go for a decontamination shower immediately afterwards.
Oh, is that what broke her up in Hiddleston?
That's the one. Yes. Also, the fact that you have never seen two people with less sexual chemistry.
Yes, this is true. Just seeing the two of them together, it just made me think, hang on, did someone say something that upset the other person? I kept thinking that whenever I saw photos of them, it looked like somebody had actually just said something that's upset the other half. In every single bit of footage of them, that's exactly what it looks like.
Yes, that is spot on. I like that Andrew Anglin did describe black people as coloured gentlemen, though. It's nice to know that you can still be polite while being an awful Nazi.
Well, yeah, even the Nazis have standards.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't just accept anyone.
But, I mean, that's part of what this Jane Austen thing is, isn't it? A yearning to get back to the age of courtesy and civility and arranged marriages, but not in a Muslim way, white people's arranged marriages. And
Which, ironically enough, is in the Muslim way.
Yes. And every time I read this, I just think, you do realise that in this polite, gentrified utopia, you think, you imagine your Twitter user pic of an anime hermaphrodite wearing SS uniform would be considered a bit much.
It depends on which country you're in, because which one was it? The Southeast Asian country, was it Taiwan or Thailand or somewhere like that? where they have this strange fascination with Hitler. They even use him.
Oh, God, yeah.
They had, like, kids painting pictures of Hitler in school, and then they had, like, a fried chicken place.
Oh, yeah, Hitler fried chicken, which is racially offensive on two different levels.
Yes, it doesn't make sense to me.
Very little about the whole fact that it's 2017 and we're having to remind people that Nazism is wrong can be said to make sense.
This is true.
The thing is, they had such nice uniforms.
Do you think that's what it is, a style thing?
I think that's entirely it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, who among us hasn't woken up in the morning, looked at our wardrobe and just thought, damn, some jackboots would make this outfit pop.
Yes, could do with a bit more Hugo Boss.
Hugo Boss jackboots, no.
Hugo Boss jackboots are Nazi jackboots. Hugo Boss made the uniforms for the Nazis.
This is true, this is true.
Which is weirdly a fact they don't advertise that much now.
I know, right? It's kind of like that biopic of Coco Chanel starring Audrey Tautou, which sort of weirdly stopped at around the mid-30s.
Yeah,
I guess she must just have not done much of interest in that time.
I was about to say, because nothing happened.
With her cat reading some Jane Austen.
Yes!
Yes, no, nothing happened after the mid-30s. Nothing. She was a hermit.
And then in the mid-40s, people just picked up and carried on.
Yes.
A good kind of breather decade, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Ah, shall we take a break there with something a little different?
Or something not different enough. Yes, because we have a clip here of a promotional video for a new children's book written by BuzzFeed's David Mack, and it's called The President and the Big Boy Truck.
Friends, we have a book we want to read today. President and the Big Boy Truck by David Mack. Work is hard, time for fun. Come outside, big surprise. It is trucks. Yeah. Honk the horn. And vroom, vroom, vroom. We see you. And let me hear your loudest scream. Fun must end. Back to work. President loves trucks. And that's the end. Should we read it again?
Yeah! I'm sort of worried it makes him adorable.
I don't know what to say to that.
Kind of is, apart from, like, you know, the horrendous sexism and racism.
Yes. If we can just overlook that.
This is true. Right. I believe I have a book, don't I?
Yeah, that's a surprise.
Yes, and it's a book by a gentleman called Jason Starr. Now,
that's it. That's all we need to know about the book.
That's the review.
Well, Jason Starr has written numerous crime fiction novels and thrillers. Cold Caller, Nothing Personal, Fake ID. He's been writing for, almost 20 years now? Mm. And he's written some books that have been interesting, I suppose. But sadly, and to get it out of the way, this one is based on Gotham, the TV series. It is Gotham, Dawn of Darkness. And I immediately take umbrage with the title, because dawn is like the beginning of the day and darkness is...
Yes, he doesn't know how daylight works.
Yes.
I mean, what he's done is he's written a book that should be called Gotham Sunset.
Yes, basically.
Which sounds like a shade of nail polish.
Yes, actually. Or a cocktail. If you can have a tequila sunrise, why not have a Gotham Sunset?
Why not?
Make mine a slippery Batman.
No, Gotham Sunset is more like a Bloody Mary, only a deeper shade of crimson. So anyway, Gotham, Dawn of Darkness. The story begins with a break-in at Wayne Manor, and Thomas Wayne is working in his office, but his office isn't his office in the manor, because Thomas Wayne is a billionaire who can do anything he wants to his own home. So he's built himself a secret office in some caves underneath his real office, so he can hide all of his secret stuff. It's like his man cave, and it literally is described as a man cave. And
so some sort of man cave filled with bats, is it?
There are some bats every so often, but Thomas quite likes it there. And the bats keep themselves to themselves. But anyway, Thomas Wayne is there one night. The family has just come back from overseas. Everyone's having jet lag. And he hears a noise and he thinks, oh, that could be Alfred or someone like that. But then he realises it's late. Nobody would be awake at this time. So he goes up and he finds that his office has been crashed. The security system hasn't worked. And there are three men wearing Halloween masks who are running away with his Picasso. And
wait. So he heard that from his office is definitely not the Batcave, wink.
Yes, exactly.
But was underground.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Not even going to go there, because there are bigger issues.
Mm.
So anyway, Thomas, basically, he gets his gun and he shoots one of them, but doesn't kill them. And the other two get away, but the one he shot pulls out his own gun. He's been taking shots at Thomas, and Thomas has been taking shots at him. The other guy's been hit. Thomas is fine, because he can't die yet. And the other guy eventually gets shot in the neck by Alfred, who appears on the stairs because he's been woken up by all of the shooting. And at this point, I'm thinking,
as you would be.
Yeah. Yes. At this point, I'm thinking, so Martha and Bruce are still asleep?
Yeah.
But apparently not. Anyway, spin on. Obviously, Thomas Wayne has called Gotham PD, and who appears but Harvey Bullock with his current partner called Amanda. And Amanda is, she's been on the force for 5 months. She thinks she knows everything, but Harvey knows better because Harvey is, you know, Harvey's appeared and Harvey has been a detective for a long time and he's buried lots of partners and he knows how everything works in Gotham and who's got the skinny on who. And he knows Gotham inside out because Harvey at that point effectively is Gotham's slightly inebriated older uncle of Batman.
So this entire book is set before the TV series Gotham.
Yes.
Which is set before Batman.
Yes.
It's a double prequel.
Yes.
Oh, God. Although maybe if you double your prequel, it stops being boring.
Well, here's the problem with Gotham Dawn of Darkness, right? Number one, it supposes that you are watching the TV series, which is a fair assumption to make. It's got, you know, Alfred and Bruce Wayne and the guy who plays Harvey Bullock in the TV series on the cover. So assuming that you're watching the TV series, that's fine. Yeah?
Yeah, that show theoretically has fans.
The problem is when it starts getting into details. Because in the TV series, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't really get to know much about Thomas Wayne.
Yeah.
No, I'm pretty sure you don't. Well, because who needs to know much about Thomas Wayne?
Yeah. You also don't need to.
The purpose of being is to be shot and killed.
Yes. You also don't get to know much about Martha Wayne. In fact, you don't get to know that Martha Wayne is a bit of a looker, according to Harvey Bullock. See, Harvey Bullock in this. This is, I'm just going to read this, right? Harvey had fired back. I'm no sexist. I'm the opposite of a sexist. If I was a sexist, I wouldn't like women as much as I do. And if I didn't like women, I'd want them to be cops so they could get hurt or be killed. But I don't want them to be cops because I love women and want them to be safe.
What?
That's certainly some writing.
Yes.
Better pack it up now, feminism. You've been out-argued.
Exactly.
This has been a productive episode, hasn't it? Founded a new religion and disproved feminism.
Yes, and we've also instituted National Rob Day.
Here's the best bit, though. This is Harvey, upon meeting Martha Wayne.
Mm.
Talk about pretty. Yowza. If you looked up Harvey's type in the Encyclopedia Britannica, you'd see a big picture of this lady. He'd seen her around a lot over the years, talked to her a few times at charity balls, GCPD functions and whatnot. She was blonde, classy, okay, a little bit on the thin side, but somehow with Martha Wayne, the whole package worked. The thing that Harvey liked most about her, though, was her confidence. In a weird way, she reminded him of Fish Mooney.
Who is a gangster in this, right?
Yes.
not a tasty seafood dish. I'm agog that this book includes the word yowza. Does he break out into a chorus of dance, dance, dance straight after this, by any chance?
Possibly. See,
is this in fact of the Flintstones?
Well, it seems like Jason Starr has tried to do this book as kind of a prequel, but also tried to do it as kind of a 1920s Mike Hammer type gumshoe private detective novel.
Mm.
You know, where
which is a workable idea, I think, for the Batman universe.
It is a workable idea, unfortunately.
Yeah, when done well.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. Jason Starr writes crime thrillers. Yes, that's fine. But it seems like he writes a lot of modern crime thrillers, and maybe if you want to do something that was more of a gumshoe novel, he should sit down and really read a lot of them so he can pick up on the actual rhythm, the flow, because these books actually did have a certain mentality to them. That was basically, they were books of their time, you know? And you can't really go back and recapture the essence of a time period. You can live in it and you can feel it and you can write it because you're in that period. But going back, you know, 70, 80, 90 years later and going, I'm going to write something as if it was from this time period, it's very, very difficult to do. Unless you are basically habitually wearing those frocks and doing the Charleston every day, you know, you're not really going to be able to understand what it was like living in the 1920s.
Which is why I understand living in the 1920s, because I do that every single day.
Is that your exercise routine?
Wake-up routine, yes. Glass of orange juice, quick Charleston, and then just slip the frock on.
So, yeah. It reads like it's trying to be a 1920s, 1930s, even 1940s detective novel. And
it reads like someone's idea of what those novels were like without having actually read them.
Yeah, basically, yeah. What he said. What I don't like about this, though, is that it basically supposes that the death of Thomas and Martha Wayne was something pre-planned. And I know that that's the angle that the TV series is trying to take, but I've always preferred the death of Thomas and Martha Wayne to be something that was just completely random and just happened because Gotham is just that type of place. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I think for me the thing is, it could be either way.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. And
like, their deaths are just a stepping stone from which the actual story starts.
Yeah, and this is the thing. It doesn't really matter. And the problem is that Thomas Wayne in this, the character of Thomas Wayne, and he does things like think... it basically takes Thomas Wayne as a character and says, okay, Thomas Wayne wasn't a saint. You know, like Arrow did with Oliver Queen's dad. How he apparently wasn't a saint, how he'd had people killed and stuff like that.
Mm.
Right? They're basically doing the same thing with this Thomas Wayne as, you know, Alfred has basically, in one scene in this, Alfred and Thomas are being chased by a guy in a black car who's shooting at them, and Alfred shoots the guy in the head as they're driving. The guy is basically trying to run them off the road. So Alfred shoots the guy in the head, which is clearly self-defense. And Alfred's rightly saying, you know, we should stick around and tell the police what's happened. And Thomas says, no, no, just drive on. I don't want any trouble. And I'm thinking, hang on. Batman has this strong sense of justice that he learned from his dad. So you're basically saying his dad is, you know, not this bastion of hope for the city, which is why some people wanted him dead, or maybe why he died in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, this does put the early Batman comics into a lot more context.
Yes.
Just... I'm going to push this guy out a window, just like Daddy taught me.
Yes, exactly. So, Gotham, Dawn of Darkness by Jason Starr. It's available now. If you're a fan of the TV series, then you probably like it. But if you're a fan of Batman, just be a bit careful.
Mm.
Also, if you're a fan of the TV series, please explain to me why.
This is true. there is a fundamental truth in this. So,
do we have a quiz? Sorry,
yes, we have a quiz, and it's a very simple quiz. Playing for points, you versus Andrew Graham.
Oh.
And these are famous last words.
Take out the reigning champ.
Yep.
Indeed.
Yes. These are famous last words.
Oh.
Famous last words of authors and philosophers and people of that ilk.
Gotcha.
So, we have a bunch of
them. Slightly worried because Graham actually knows about books and stuff.
Yeah, that's
my unfair advantage.
Knowing about books isn't the same as knowing what these people said when they died.
Correct.
And I've tried to exclude some of the more obvious ones, like either that wallpaper goes or I do.
Yes.
So, beginning at the first one, obviously. What's that? Does my face look strange?
Was it Mr. Potato Head?
No.
Oh, do we not get options?
Nope.
That's blimey. Oh. What's that? Does my face look strange?
Okay, I'll give you choices. Okay.
Well, thank you. Yes.
I'll give you options, right? It could be Herman Melville, Winston Churchill, or Robert Louis Stevenson.
I cannot imagine does my face look strange as being a sentiment Winston Churchill had often. I think he was blithely unconcerned about his face looking strange.
Plus, I feel like, with moments left on Earth, Winston Churchill's first priority is going to be more booze.
Yes! Just took it to my veins, was his last words. I think it's Robert Louis Stevenson.
Andrew?
I was also leaning towards Stevenson.
So you're both going for Stevenson?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, it's a point each then.
Ooh! I assumed that Herman Melville's last words would be a really long digression about the uses of whale oil that most people skip over.
Possibly. Right. Next one. I must go in. The fog is rising. Was that Lewis Carroll, Karl Marx, or Emily Dickinson?
Oh, interesting.
I mean, I was hoping one of the options would be like Mary Shelley. Does that just seem like vaguely horror-esque?
It's very true. I think as a nature poet, Emily Dickinson might have said that.
Andrew?
I'm going to swerve and go for Lewis Carroll.
Graham gets the point. It's 2-1.
Car?
See, this is where it's not fair. He knows who these people actually are.
This Dora, is you've still got plenty of time to pull this one back. Don't worry, it's only a point difference. Next one.
But I'm not used to this losing business.
Don't worry. Next one. Does nobody understand? Was that James Joyce, Herman Melville, or Ian Fleming?
I'm going to say Herman Melville, because that was after the lengthy tertiary on the uses of whale oil.
See, before you read out the options, I was actually going to say James Joyce as a joke answer. Just, you know, his last words before that were probably a 900-word stream of consciousness sentence. So I will go. Yes, I'll go Joyce.
Andrew?
Yeah, that's it. I'm sticking with Herman Melville.
Graham takes the point again.
Car?
It's collusion is what it is. Blatant cheating.
Okay. I want nothing but death. Was that Henry David Thoreau, Lope de Vega, or Jane Austen?
Well, Jane Austen's last words were we need to secure a future for our precious white children, weren't they? All hail the glorious Reich. I'm going to risk it. I'm going to do what Rob usually does and say the one that I am not familiar with, the middle one.
Lope de Vega.
That's, yes.
And Andrew?
I mean, I don't remember what the other two were apart from Jane Austen, but I also feel like it's not Jane Austen. So I'll just say the first one.
Okay, that was Henry David Thoreau.
If you say so.
You're both wrong. It was actually Jane Austen.
You're kidding. I mean, that's what I say after I'm finished a Jane Austen novel, but wow.
Yes.
That's Bronte sisters dark from Jane Austen.
I know. I'm bored with it all. Was that Johann Wolfgang Goethe, Franz Kafka, or Winston Churchill?
Well, that's interesting. There isn't one that jumps out at me as being incorrect. I will say Kafka.
Andrew?
Churchill.
Well done, Andrew. You pull a point back.
Yeah, am I winning yet? Have I won now? Can't we just say I've won and end the game?
Not yet. He's still a point behind. It's 3-2. Okay, the next one is simply Moose Indian. Was that Lewis Carroll, Anton Chekhov, or Henry David Thoreau?
Ah, well, Thoreau lived in the wilderness for a long time, so it could be him.
See, part of me wants to say it was Chekhov, and ironically, neither the moose or the Indian had any later relevance.
Actually, I think I'll say Carroll.
Okay. Andrew?
See, I'm tempted to say Thoreau because you said he lived in the wilderness. But what if that's just a deliberate attempt to sabotage me because you're threatened by my intellect?
I'm not that strategic.
I'll go for Chekhov because I haven't heard of the other guy.
You're both wrong. It was Henry David Thoreau.
Oh! You overthought it.
I did. I had three in the palm of my hand and I fluffed it.
You could have pulled level there, Andrew.
Okay, I've changed my mind. I want to go for Thoreau instead.
Too late, unfortunately.
Not how causality works.
Yes, moving on. Take away these pillows. I won't need them any longer. Was that Ian Fleming, Voltaire, or Lewis Carroll?
I definitely think Voltaire.
The kind of practicality I could see from Ian Fleming.
Mm.
But of the three, Voltaire is the one I could see, like, lounging on a gigantic pile of pillows.
All this
I might go for Voltaire as well.
All is for the best in my lovely, luxurious bed, as he so neatly said.
You're both wrong, it was Lewis Carroll.
What? I suppose one of them had to be Lewis Carroll eventually, but oh man.
Yep. Okay. God Bless Captain Veer. Was that...
What?
Yeah, God Bless Captain Veer. Was that Anton Chekhov, Charles Dickens, or Herman Melville?
Oh, Melville. It's no doubt some old sea captain that he used to know.
Of the three, I think I'm tempted to go for the one who was obsessed with whaling as well.
Okay.
Yes.
That's a point each, so it's 4-3 now.
Car.
Yeah.
Big scoring. This must be our highest scoring quiz ever.
I think it is.
Okay, next up. I am sorry to trouble you, chaps. I don't know how you get along so fast with the traffic on the road these days. Was that Truman Capote, Ian Fleming, or Karl Marx?
I mean, this isn't the most rational part of my brain speaking, but I would love it if Karl Marx, one of the most influential political thinkers in the history of the human race, had a set of last words that were that dopey.
I'm going to say Ian Fleming because I can't imagine either of the two colleagues want chaps.
Yes, that's also true. I'm sticking with Marx, though.
And Andrew draws level.
Ooh.
Yay. Tactics.
Yes.
By which I mean arbitrarily choosing things based on completely unliterary-based hypotheses.
Yes.
Guessing is a kind of tactic.
So, Kill Me or You Are a Murderer. Was that Johann Wolfgang Goethe, Voltaire, or Franz Kafka?
I'm going to say Goethe. He was a bit melodramatic. He was always into drama, as the kids say these days.
Well, didn't Kafka kill himself?
Oh, I seem to think he died of TB. Let me just have a morbid Wikipedia search.
Are you Googling? No Googling.
Yes, sorry. You know, I am not Googling that.
Hold on while I Google what was Franz Kafka's last words.
Yes, fair point, well made. No, I'm sticking with Goethe.
I think I'll go for Kafka.
And Andrew takes the lead.
Ooh.
Oh,
yay! The idiot savant is doing it again.
Now, my good man, this is no time to be making enemies. Was that Charles Dickens, Anton Chekhov, or Voltaire?
I feel like it could be Chekhov.
What was the first one again?
Charles Dickens.
No, that just doesn't seem Dickens-y to me. I think I'll also have to go for Chekhov.
You're both going for Chekhov?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
It was Voltaire.
Was it Chekhov?
No, it was Voltaire.
Oh.
All right, then. I'll say it. Dante makes me sick. Was that... was that Lope de Vega, Karl Marx, or Anton Chekhov?
D. Kevin Smith.
D. Beatrice. That's a very good one. Okay, I'll say Marx. I realise this has got me into bother before, but I'm saying Marx.
I'm going to need the questions again, because I'll admit I was too distracted by my excellent Kevin Smith joke to actually listen to the answers.
Lope de Vega, Karl Marx, or Anton Chekhov?
I'll say Lope de Vega, because that's a fun name to say.
Andrew's taking a 2-point lead.
Wow.
And finally, go on, get out. Last words are for fools who haven't said enough. Was that Truman Capote, Johann Wolfgang Goethe, or Karl Marx?
I believe I've heard that before, and I believe, now you've said it, I realise I've also said this answer for everything else, but I think that's Marx.
I'm going to say Capote and let you have Marx, because I'll be happy enough if it is him.
It was Karl Marx.
Yeah.
But Andrew wins again.
See, you're good.
See, you and your books and your learning, where does it get you?
Nowhere. This is completely true.
It's all about who has the funniest name. That's the right answer.
So, yeah, that was Famous Last Words. We have been Literary Loitering. We also had Gotham Dawn of Darkness, the rather oxymoronic title. Would it be correct in saying that?
Yes.
I found it amusing that the word oxymoron actually just means acutely stupid. So, yeah, we've had those things and a quiz. We've had fun.
Yes.
Now it's time for our final words.
Yes. I'm going now. I'm going to cough up a lung.
Yes, I'm going to have to dash, and because I am filming this afternoon.
Oh, which yes.
Is fun.
Yes, yes. Oh, Graham is a filmmaker. And erstwhile actor as well.
Yes.
I think you should have that on your resume, erstwhile actor.
Erstwhile actor and chopped off all the foreigners' hands.
Once took part in Nazi Idol. Singing, get into the Reich.
So on that bombshell.
Yes. I have been Rob.
I've been Graham.
I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all next time.
Thanks for listening.